Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello once again and welcome to Reads Like a Four, the podcast that deals with critics, reviews and cultural criticism. I'm your host Adam Brooks and this week's guest is...
Sam Parker.
Here's Sam talking a little bit about his career in journalism so far.
So I realised thanks to Facebook that I actually moved to London almost 9 years ago to the day. And my first job was working for FHM and Zoo Magazine, rest in peace, which was an excellent kind of introduction to the industry. I left university convinced that I was sort of destined for great things, and it was quite humbling to suddenly find myself doing vox pops on Oxford Street with a zoo t-shirt on and a cardboard cutout of Katy Perry, or eating the UK's biggest burger for a photo shoot. So that was my kind of introduction, was the lads mags. After that, I worked for AOL. That was my first full-time job on their music site. And then I was fortuitous to be there when they bought the Huffington Post and launched that in the UK, which at the time was kind of the new kid on the block, the exciting website in the UK. I pitched to my then editor that I'd like to do a arts and book section, which wasn't in the original plan. And they decided to go for it. And I found myself reviewing books and art shows despite not knowing a huge amount about art, and it was absolutely fantastic. I did that for about a year, and then I was involved in another what would go on to be quite a significant launch in the UK, which was BuzzFeed. So I was on the launch team for BuzzFeed UK, which was probably the most fun I've ever had, I think, in journalism. I was only there for a few months at the beginning, but we were basically just sat in a room trying to come up with funny ways to make a name for ourselves in the UK market, using the kind of shareable listicle format that had been successful in the US. From there, I moved to Esquire 5 years ago to join their digital team as deputy digital editor. And then was made digital editor a few years later, which is the role I'm still in now. I edit everything, really, from kind of men's style to entertainment. So film and TV, a little bit of music, a little bit of sport. And the area that I guess I'm most interested in, I suppose, which is the long form stuff that we do, which is kind of features on just about anything that that is interesting or different or kind of or a person, you know, it could be a profile, anything that's kind of interesting, kind of 3,000 to 4,000 words plus. And I write a little bit of that as well. So that's me.
So given that Sam's worked at BuzzFeed, Empire, The Huffington Post and edits long-form journalism outlet The Queue, we talked a lot about the balance, benefits and drawbacks of both short and long-form journalism, as well as masculinity and how it's represented on Esquire's platforms, Twitter and whether journalists have a responsibility as far as the health of their readers goes. So without further ado, let's get on with this episode of Readers Like a Four, episode 18 with Sam Parker. Perfect. Okay, so I mean, that seems a good place to start. Actually, you mentioned just now that you've obviously worked for, I guess you kind of worked almost at two extremes in terms of the length of writing. You know, BuzzFeed, a lot of the early articles that you might have been involved with were pretty short on words and kind of designed to garner attention. And now you obviously, as well as commissioning long form stuff for Esquire, you also co-edit The Queue, I believe, which deals solely in long form journalism. I wondered what the appeals are of short versus long form and what the rules are. I mean, things like, if you're writing a piece about the history of a country, can that be anything but a long read? And do lists only work as an article of 500 words or less? Kind of, how do you decide what's long form and what isn't?
Oh, well, I think if you were going to take the example of the history of a country, it would be far better as a listicle with lots of pictures than 3,000, 4,000 words. Yeah, I suppose they are kind of two extremes, although BuzzFeed did go on to and does produce a lot of good quality long form as well. Mm-hmm. My first hit with BuzzFeed, which at the time we considered anything with over a million views, was The Nine Types of Hangover You Can Have, as illustrated by pictures of owls. And, you know, that was a short piece, although, you know, it had a little bit of writing in it. And that remains one of my sort of proudest pieces, I suppose. But if the question is, how do you decide whether a subject warrants a long or a short read?
Yeah,
I think it depends on what you're setting out to achieve. Are you more looking to entertain or inform? Who was the writer doing it, and where do their strengths lie? I sort of think that any subject within reason. Well, certainly any subject can be treated with levity and you know, concise wit, if you like, which is what they do at BuzzFeed, and can be made kind of fun. Whether anything can be a long read is more debatable. I think you need to have multiple strands, you need to have multiple sources, you need to have some kind of narrative that you can switch gears between. You know, scene setting and colour, going back to facts and information. So there's a lot more, obviously, there's a lot more going on in a long form piece. But yeah, I kind of take it on a case by case basis. Certainly as a writer, I can think of examples where I set out to do an interview, for example, that should have by rights been a relatively short form piece, a Q&A, that turned into a longer interview that you know, was almost long form length. So it's definitely case by case.
Okay. And what would you say about perhaps the argument some people have that long form articles are better read in print, that they're harder to read online? I wonder if there was any kind of, if there's research or any sort of studies that you or Esquire have taken out about how pieces like that are consumed online.
Yeah. I mean, there are a few different schools of thought with it. Obviously, reading a long form article in print is a beautiful experience and a very pleasurable thing. I mean, I subscribe to the London Review of Books, and every fortnight it comes in, and you know, it's one of the great pleasures of my kind of week to sit down with that and read it very slowly, you know, by candlelight or whatever, you know, the romantic long form thing. But also, people do it on their phones. And what we find at Esquire is that some of our most popular articles of all time are actually in that bracket of three to 5,000 words long. There are different schools of thought. I mean, the first kind of memorable long read, I suppose, long read moment online was, I think it was the New York Times. I've forgotten the name of it now. Was it called Snowfall or something like that? Mm-hmm. They really went to town with it. Was a story of some natural disaster, and they really went to town with moving graphics and beautiful pictures and did the whole thing on it. And a lot of people just found it kind of unreadable, you know. And then you look at, again, the London Review of Books, you know, they put their long reads up very, very simply. I think, you know, sometimes sort of 50,000 words long. And it will just be text and it can go viral. So I don't think there's any hard and fast rules with it. Certainly, I think chunking the article up, which, to use a term that we use at Hearst, I don't know if that's kind of industry wide or not, but, you know, making sure that you break things up with pictures, video, if appropriate, pull quotes. Hey, it's the same premise as what they do on print. There is the risk of overdoing it and getting too bells and whistles about it, which then becomes a distraction. And this is something that myself and my fellow long read geeks at the Q, we kind of debate among ourselves from time to time, is, you know, what is the optimum amount of stuff that isn't text in your long read? And I think, you know, as long as stuff is in there because it adds to the story rather than just being there for the sake of it, then I think you're along the right lines.
Yeah. In terms of long form pieces across Esquire, how much crossover is there between what's in the print mag and the online content? Do all articles in print eventually make it online, or are they entirely distinct?
So I would say in the long read, certainly almost all go online. Mm-hmm. Not everything else that goes into print, it kind of works for digital, often because it's too short, actually.
Right.
You know, obviously on this kind of, if you think about the front of a magazine where it's often kind of product driven and caption sort of driven, if you try and take that and put it online, it just looks so small as to be as to feel not quite right. But certainly the long reads we take, the cover story each month goes online. And yeah, like I say, they're some of our most popular pieces. And, you know, we're very lucky. I'm very lucky to work for a magazine that places a lot of value in that kind of journalism, and one of the few magazines or print publications in the UK that's really devoted to it. And you know, spend a lot of time and money on it, frankly.
Yeah. And do you find that the people consuming Esquire's online writing and the people buying the print magazine are demographically similar? I mean, presumably it's largely male, but is the remit in the kind of stories that you'll include the same?
Yeah, basically. I mean, yeah, you're right. It's about 70 to 75% male online. I would imagine it's similar, if not a little higher, when it comes to print, although I don't know for sure. Yeah, I mean, what we did find once when we did a little bit of sort of demographic research was that men who read the website are younger than the men who read print, but they think that the website is being read by older men, if that makes sense.
Right, I see.
So
they imagine they're amongst the youngest bracket of people reading online, when in fact they're not necessarily.
No, it's that they believe that the other people reading the website are older.
Yeah, and yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, so they're sort of joining an older club of people, I suppose. But no, I mean, you know, it's very, very hard. I mean, the audiences are different. Obviously, online you can get big spikes of audiences because of one story that got picked up in one area of Reddit or something like that, and then that can skew the sort of demographic, you know, for that week or that day. Whereas the print obviously have a subscription base that they know they're talking to all of the time, so it is slightly different. But yeah, it's fundamentally it's the same guy. It's a young, educated, aspirational guy who likes good writing and a bit of irreverence and enjoys, you know, the finer things in life, but still wants to read some heavy hitting things about politics or whatever from time to time as well.
Mm-hmm. Does there come a point at editor level where curation or the ability to find unique voices and ideas and stories becomes as important a skill as being able to write a good piece yourself? Do you think there's a point when you kind of reach an editor's level where recognizing great writing in other people becomes more important than having writing it yourself?
Yeah, and it's really annoying because you don't get any of the acclaim or the you don't get your names on the pieces anymore. No, I think if you're a journalist who really loves writing and that's your first love, and then you reach a certain point as an editor, there is this kind of moment, this kind of existential crisis where you feel like you're at a sort of fork in the road where it's like, okay, I'm either going to continue to be a writer, which often means going freelance when you've hit a certain ceiling on a publication, or you become an editor, and then your job and your life becomes a lot more about identifying and elevating and refining the work of other people, as you say. And I think, you know, the two are sort of obviously very closely linked. I don't think you can be a good editor without being a good writer. You can certainly be a good writer without being a good editor necessarily, but I think if you're going to be a good editor, you have to, at the core, be a solid writer. Mm-hmm. And I suppose at that point it does become more important being able to identify other people's ability and bring the best out in them. I mean, it's a difficult thing because writers are very unique. We're very special snowflakes, aren't we? And we all have egos and opinions and that sort of a thing. But finding the stories and finding the writers is definitely, for me now, kind of the main challenge of the job, I suppose, on the editorial side.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
And is it very easy when someone brings you an idea or a pitch, is it very easy to identify whether that pitch is Esquire or isn't? I guess there's nothing as simple as a list of criteria, but what are the kind of factors you bear in mind?
I think I've always thought of the long read section as kind of where the parameters of what is on brand, if you like, is at its absolute broadest. So, if somebody comes with a great long read idea and it doesn't fall into one of the typical columns of what Esquire does, you know, style and sport and everything else, that's not necessarily a problem as long as the idea is good enough and the pitch is strong enough and the writer is good enough. I mean, clearly, you know, there are some pitches you get that you look at and you go, well, that belongs in the New Statesman or that belongs in Elle magazine. It doesn't belong in Esquire. Mm-hmm. That does happen, but that isn't usually driven by it is usually driven by the subject, but I do try and be really open-minded when it comes to what we'll cover. I mean, for example, one of my favorite long reads we've published in the last year was a piece on the story behind Wetherspoons and how that chain came to be and the entrepreneur behind it. Wetherspoons is not a brand that we would touch, frankly, in any other way.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't put it in our food and drink section. We wouldn't talk about it in our like going out or travel or anything like that. But because the story was good enough, the business story behind it was interesting enough, and the writer was very good, then I ran it. So you do have a sense of whether something is an Esquire story or not, but I try and keep that as broad as possible when it comes to long reads.
Okay. And a bit more broadly, are there trends in journalism at the moment that you think are counterproductive? And are there new forms of writing or new ways of getting ideas in front of people that are encouraging?
Trends in writing. I don't know about counterproductive. I mean, there are very annoying trends that come up in journalism that we can all be, the digital journalism has in some ways been one succession of annoying trend after the other that actually the job is to avoid rather than participate in. The clickbait period, the period where everybody was writing for Google, which has now sort of come back, and these things push your headlines and your copy into a certain direction that doesn't normally fit the brand that you're with.
Mm-hmm.
So these aren't great trends. One trend that really annoyed me was the confessional personal essay that everybody was doing. It seemed to me that a bunch of kind of people in their early 20s were being convinced that writing some embarrassing story about their sex life was kind of going to get them ahead in their career,
And certainly it felt interesting to begin with, but then I think, certainly the problem for me was that there wasn't a diverse enough range of journalists writing these articles, so they all tended to be of a type.
Yes. I mean, that's a wider problem in journalism, isn't it? Anyway, but yeah, you're right. It became this sort of bizarre arms race for who could write the most excruciatingly embarrassing confessional about something that happened to them at university or something. That wasn't a good trend. I didn't like the kind of the Upworthy, is that what it was called? Upworthy, the real clickbait headlines thing that was going on for a long time, and then clickbait kind of become this term that people use whenever they didn't like an article, when originally it meant a headline that promised something far in excess of what the article delivered.
Mm-hmm.
That was a bad phase. There's been lots of them because we're in this strange phase where we're figuring it out, and my hope and my faith is that long term what we're all circling back in on is what print has kind of known and been doing for decades, centuries, which is that quality will win out and knowing your audience and speaking to them directly will win out in the end. And eventually all of the kind of the tricks and the the shortcuts to traffic and all that kind of thing will lose. And journalism will win. That's kind of the on my more optimistic days, that's how I think of it.
Yeah. Well, on that theme, I wanted to talk a little bit about Twitter because I wondered if it feels to me a little bit the kind of the growth of social media, particularly Twitter as an example, has in some ways helped journalism a lot, because I find that what draws me to long reads now is seeing lots of people recommend it, people that I trust and people that I like, and that's not something that necessarily would have happened if Twitter wasn't around. It's certainly not something that necessarily would have happened in print. So do you think to an extent Twitter makes journalism more accessible, or is there an argument that now we can hear directly from famous people and news stories are often broken on Twitter, that it's doing the things that journalism used to?
Oh, that's a good question. Is it doing the things that journalism used to? I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. I think fundamentally it supports journalism and helps it spread, and that is something we should be thankful for.
I guess the character limit alone means that it's never going to be a replacement for journalism.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends. You know, if you're talking about breaking a news story in its simplest facts, then I suppose perhaps it has replaced traditional journalism in some ways, or at least exists alongside it. I've never been a political journalist or a news reporter, never wanted to be. But, I imagine that if I had a piece of breaking news, then I'd go to Twitter before I would, you know, build an article on my website. Whether it, going back to the long form thing, I mean, yeah, it definitely helps things spread. And a lot of stories live or die by how well it performs on Twitter. I do remember when Twitter used to be funny, you know, which I say facetiously, but also with seriousness. It used to be that Facebook was a real... Sorry, Twitter was within itself a very creative kind of platform.
Yeah, I do feel sometimes like every time I log in, I'm being presented with a series of urgent crises.
It's become this sort of braying, incessant, you know, performative space where it's supposed to be this barometer of public mood and all that sort of thing. And I think perhaps it is to an extent, but certainly journalists in particular get way too bogged down in it. And
I was going to ask you about this because your Twitter bio describes it as a place where journalists act like celebrities and celebrities act like journalists. I wondered what you meant by that specifically.
I think what I mean by that is that, celebrities use it to circumnavigate the traditional press and speak directly to their fans and set the record straight and all that. And I think that's good for celebrities and it probably clears up a lot of nonsense. Journalists in kind of reverse like to think that that they're kind of celebrities and that they're terribly important. And, you know, the following that you have and the caliber of the people who talk to you on there and which kind of little cliques you're in and everything is kind of important. And that's something that as the years have gone by, I've just become less interested in, I suppose, although that isn't to say that I'm not still, you know, beholden to the site and on it every day. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do think that journalists, it's a very, when what you do is right, And Twitter is a platform where people are writing things all day. You know, it's like it's kind of an ego boost, isn't it? And I always think about the books we all could have written. if you were to put all the words together that I've sort of tossed into Twitter for some tiny bump of what do you call it when you get a
Like a dopamine hit.
Dopamine hit. You know, I've kind of wasted a lot of time and energy on it, but you know, it's still a good platform for finding writers. I mean, we have a couple of columnists online who are great writers that I only knew through Twitter, really, and got to know their writing that way, and certainly I've commissioned journalists pretty much on the basis of something that they've tweeted, how funny they are on Twitter, the points that they make on Twitter. So you know, it is powerful, and it's easy to be kind of cynical about and dismissive of. But I don't think it's replaced journalism. I think that would be a sad day indeed. I think it's another tool, but it shouldn't be the only tool. And I think that's the trap, is that you start to think that somehow the noise on Twitter represents the wider public opinion. And I think, you know, without getting too kind of grandiose, I think that you can see that problem in lots of areas of public life, some that are far more important than journalism.
Yeah, well, certainly there's been a kind of the equivalent of a slap in the face for people that felt that Twitter was reflective of society every time there's any kind of election or referendum, I guess.
You know. Yeah, Twitter told me Ed Miliband was going to win. I was all ready for it.
Well, there you go. Yeah, yeah.
You know, I went to bed thinking I was going to wake up to an Ed Miliband Britain, and it didn't happen. Twitter's fault.
Absolutely. to stay on the subject of technology a little bit, and forgive me because this is a bit of a reach, but one of your longer pieces online that I read was about unplugging from technology and isolating yourself in a Scottish bothy for a week and the benefits to one's health and one's state of mind. I wondered, how do you square that with the responsibility you have to put a certain number of articles online and the need to increase engagement? Is there any, you know, some people would argue that, you know, fast food companies or city planners have a responsibility to the people they serve, you know, and to their health. Do you think there's a responsibility amongst journalists to a reader's health to not waste their time, to not mislead them, to not promise an article that then isn't what's delivered?
Wow. that's a big question, Adam.
Yeah.
Is it our responsibility? No, I don't think it's our responsibility to limit the amount we publish, although I think certainly some publications should certainly consider it. the digital detox thing, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, you know, you see Apple making making gestures now to get your phone to tell you when you've been on it too long and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I sort of think it's one of those things that will just iron itself out with successive generations. I think we've already seen that, you know, the Snapchat generation are far more savvy with their privacy, for example, than my generation were. You know, we were the guinea pigs of Facebook and we threw everything on there and we thought, this is fantastic, let's live our life out in the open. And it seems to me that kind of instinctively people who are 10 years younger are more protective of their privacy and are more drawn to ephemeral kind of social media. And so I think perhaps that in time we will learn to spend less time on social media in the same way that we now watch less telly than we used to, and, you know, probably listen to less radio than we once did. I don't know. It's a difficult question. But I certainly don't think the responsibility falls on journalists. We've got enough to do.
Well, I agree too. That's very much my token devil's advocate question, really. But while we're tackling massive themes and coming to the end of the episode, I thought you'd be a good person to talk to, given that you started your career on the street for Zoo, and obviously now working at Esquire, two very different types of men's magazine or men's outlet. Do you think there's been a change in the nature of masculinity, and how has that altered what Esquire covers? I've talked to several guests about the more obvious changes, like the kind of slow withdrawal of women from the cover of print magazines. But have you noticed a deeper shift in the kinds of topics men want to read about and the kind of viewpoints that they enjoy or are prepared to tolerate?
Another tough one.
It is. I apologize.
No, it's a good question. And, you know, what's happening with masculinity is one of the big questions at the moment that certainly not just Esquire is trying to answer. I think everybody is trying to figure that one out. And it's something that in my personal life I've given a lot of thought to, and in my professional life. A few years ago, I think it was 2005, I wrote a piece for print for Esquire that was about male suicide. Mm-hmm. And it was in the wake of the government survey that pointed out, I think for the first time, that suicide had become the number one killer of all men under 50 in the UK. And that was something that Alex Bilmes, who is the editor of Esquire print, he encouraged me to write. I don't know if that's something that would have made it into a kind of glossy lifestyle magazine 10 years ago. Possibly not. Sorry, there's just a train going by my window.
That's okay.
So I think the conversation around mental health has become a lot more open. And I think the media has definitely played a role in that, as has celebrities and charities have done the most amount of work. Charities like Calm and you know, the Samaritans. So I think that has been one change. Going back to your opening point about, you know, women on the covers and all that kind of thing, Yeah, I mean, that has definitely changed, even in just the sort of 10 years almost that I've been in journalism. Mm-hmm. Attitudes have changed for the better, I think. Other areas of masculinity, I don't know. It's difficult to say, but that's part of the challenge and it's part of the fun of our job is to try and reflect the way that men are changing. You know, some things never change, you know. Men still want to read cool stories about sportsmen and look at nice watches. Well, some men do, not all, but, you know, so some things never change. But, yeah, I mean, clearly society has changed massively, and part of our job and part of the fun of it is to reflect that. I mean, you know, the publications that stood still on these issues are gone. And so you have to evolve. You have to evolve with the platforms that you're working on and the tools at your disposal, but also you have to evolve with the things that you, the topics that you talk about and the attitudes that you reflect. And I like to think that Esquire does a good job of it. I think lots of other, I think the remaining men's publications and websites in the UK, generally speaking, also do a good job of it.
It certainly feels like the survivors are the ones that have, you know, are more willing to adapt and change fairly quickly, I suppose.
Yeah, but I think it doesn't just apply to men's magazines. I mean, you know, you look at the way that newspapers report things is very different now as well.
Mm, yeah.
And rightly so, I think.
Absolutely. So a final question before we get to a brief quiz. I wondered how we talked a little bit about diversity in writing earlier. I wondered from how diverse a group of people do you receive pitches? Do you find that the majority of people writing for Esquire, which is primarily a portal for men, are men? Do you find that the popularity of pieces written by women is you know equal or better to those written by men? Do you find that that women or people of colour are less likely to pitch to you? Kind of what's the state of diversity in terms of who pitches to you and what variety of writers you commission?
Well, our most popular story ever was written by Catlin Moran. So it certainly isn't the case that, you know, only male writers can write for Esquire or anything like that. You know, we have female staff writers, of course, and always have done. In terms of what I get pitched, that's difficult to say. I mean, you know, I get emails from people I don't know what their background is in every case. But I like to think that we do, you know, we do publish from as broad a range of people from as broad a range of backgrounds as possible. But it's at the end of the day, it's about the quality of the story and the quality of the writer. Mm-hmm. You know, sounds like a cop out, but it is. You know, I mean, when you get a great pitch from somebody, you don't consider where they're from, you just or who they are really. You just consider can they write and is it a good idea?
Yeah.
Journalism more broadly clearly has a problem with diversity, and you only have to look at the statistics to see that. You know, there aren't enough people from diverse backgrounds in journalism, and a lot of that has to do with the way the industry is kind of made difficult at the very beginning with things like unpaid internships and most of broadsheet writers and are kind of from privately educated backgrounds and that kind of a thing. But that isn't something that I think is a big problem at Esquire.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good to know. This is probably a good point for me to mention to people as well. There's an organization that I've been on and off involved with that sort of seeks to increase people's access to creative jobs like journalism. So if anyone Googles Arts Emergency, it's definitely worth a look there to see what they might be able to do to help you if you're thinking of becoming a journalist or working in the creative arts, or if you already work in the creative arts and want to kind of offer some help to kind of level the playing field, then Arts Emergency is a good place to look up. So that brings us more or less to the end of the episode, but we end every episode of the podcast with a brief quiz. So I've got five phrases or short passages passages here. Some of them were written by you, some of them were not written by you, and I wondered if you'd be able to tell the difference. So so here we go with number one.
Okay.
Marcella has always been a bit unhinged. It's the sort of crime drama that, if you saw it on the street, you'd keep your head down and hope it wasn't going to come over and talk to you. Is that you or is that not you?
I don't know what Marcella is, so it can't be me.
Okay, that's right. That's Louisa Meller from Den of Geek on Marcella, the TV series. Number two, LeBlanc, who will presumably be reviving his popular 90s catchphrase, "How you doing?" each time he sees an impressive chassis, has been chosen as the man to co-lead Top Gear 2.0 and increase the show's popularity in America, where they also have cars.
Oh, God. Maybe me. I'm going to say no.
It was you, I'm afraid. That was you on Matt LeBlanc's announcement as the future host of Top Gear back in 2016. So that's one out of two so far. Number three. While The Walking Dead's gnashing shufflers aren't much of a threat anymore, Thrones walkers are a frantic force of destruction, ultra creepy to look at and seemingly unstoppable, as every victim they claim becomes a new undead soldier.
Definitely not me.
That isn't you. That's Ben Turner in the Evening Standard looking back at Game of Thrones Series 5. So two out of three. Number four. Ever since the turn of the millennium, we've been gritting our teeth as the greatest movie actor of the 70s and 80s churned out turkey after turkey, seemingly content just to still be working in his dotage.
Not me.
That one is you. That's that's you on, again, we've gone back to 2016, you on Robert De Niro's Hands of Stone.
No,
so there we go, 50% success rate. And finally, number five. Because whether you like it or not, music in 2014 isn't about bands or rappers or even, really, men. It's about smart, talented women in their 20s who you have a slightly unedifying crush on and secretly listen to on Spotify.
That sounds like it might have been me, yeah.
That one was you. That's you on Taylor Swift in 2014. So that's a three out of five. Not too shabby.
Nice one.
Super. That's the end of the quiz and the end of the episode. Thanks so much, Sam, for talking to us.
No problem. Be the pleasure.
There we are. My thanks to Sam for joining me this week. If you enjoyed this episode, I recommend trying episode 8 with Shortlist's Chris Mandel, who had lots to say about what a men's magazine should be doing in 2018, and also episode 15 with Boyd Hilton of Heat and Pilot TV magazine fame, who talked in depth as well about how to position a magazine and what happens when you need to rethink your strategy. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at ReadsLikeA4 on both of those. I'm especially keen in future episodes to speak to writers of colour, LGBTQI plus writers, food and restaurant critics, and book and literary critics. So if you are one or if you know one, please email readslikeA4@gmail.com. I'll be back next week with a brand new chat with another critic. Until then, thanks so much for listening. If you're enjoying what you hear, please do drop us a review on iTunes. It really does help. And feel free to get in touch. As I mentioned, readslikeA4@gmail.com. Until next time, thanks and goodbye.